response about, it's in the news now, of course, abortions. What was that response all about, and what was the overall approach?
And it was a point where various Gedolim were being asked about it. My sense is that overall, the American school, meaning Moshe Feinstein, were more severe, more stringent on the subject than the Israelis, and Weinberg would be closer to the Israelis in this regard. And the kind of questions came up, whether saving life of the mother, well, does that include psychiatric distress? You say, well, wouldn't be in danger of doing something to herself. Would that count as a halachically acceptable reason? But again, he analyzed the subject matter. And
his conclusions were?
He was more, again, more open than Moshe.
Okay. When you go through the responsa, you see so many different types of rabbis' personalities coming to him with questions. What attracted all of these different types of rabbinical figures to go to Rav Weinberg for their questions?
Dull point is that in those days people wrote letters. There was no internet. Phones didn't work the way they do today. So people, widely, they would ask somebody higher up in the hierarchy if they needed advice. So that was one reason that it was in demand. There were people who were students, and there were people who maintained a very close relationship, even in later years. There was a man named Shmuel Atlas, who studied in Berlin. He ended up teaching in the Reform Seminary in New York, J.I.R., taught Talmud. He also did important work in history of philosophy, 18th century Solomon Maimon. And they had a very active correspondence. Despite the fact that Atlas was religiously at that point far removed from Richel Weinberg. Again, it's true about other Gedolim as well. You think the Chazon Ish is not being the most lenient person in the world, but there are also people that he influenced who were very far from Torah mitzvot and who never was welcome in his home, and he treated them well. Weinberg was really, he's very isolated at that point, and he wrote about personal feelings. Again, I think in the later years, for the Israeli rabbinate, just somebody who was counted. And again, I think that at that period of the Israeli rabbinate, there was much more consultation and contact than there might be today. Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi, and Friday morning there was a session in his home with various major Rosh Yeshiva, Zalman Meltzer, and the like, which ostensibly they were studying Talmud. I'm sure they did study Talmud, but it was also a forum where they were able to converse about matters that were important to them. They're much more open in that regard.
We had interviewed a couple weeks ago your colleague and I assume friend, Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, who you worked together with on some of the Agnel projects. What was the connection between Rabbi Weinberg and Nobel laureate Shai Agnel?
He was Mr. Kiddushin for me, arranged marriage. But there's a story behind that.
Okay.
Agnon had gone to Germany around 1913 or so. Shokin, his editor, thought that he would become a greater world writer if he had that additional experience. He stayed there for about 12 years. During that period, Agnon was not practicing orthodoxy. I think both Rabbi Sachs and I agree. Our instinct is he was not anti, but that you can infer really based on Agnon's characters. And you know, Agnon was a fiction writer, so you can't be 100% sure about these things, but it seems that the people, his narrators, are people just drifted away rather than, it's not clear exactly what brought him back, other than that his house burnt down and in Germany, and he felt that that was a sign to get back to Israel, and then he was already the person we knew later on. So he was not practicing orthodoxy. The woman who became his wife grew up in a very vigorous Orthodox home, but she turned away. And she did not return when he did. And of the kids, the daughter was like Agnon and the son was like his mother. So Mr. Marx, the father-in-law, objected to the shidduch. And he was a wealthy man. So Rabbanim didn't want to start up with him. The couple went to Michael Weinberg. And at least what he's reported to have said, he said, why should I not marry them? They don't need parental consent. And apart from that, I don't really know what these people are up to. But if I refuse to marry them Jewishly, they may live together. Why should I do this? So he arranged the wedding. A few years later, he met Mr. Marx. And Mr. Marx said, you know, we go back together. You arranged a wedding for my daughter. And Weinberg said, you're right. And Marx said to him, you know, I objected very strenuously to that because, you know, the guy was a Polish Jew, wasn't even from. And but now a few years have passed, and it turns out that he is from, and he is what he the kind of person that I would want to have as a son-in-law. And I appreciate that you did this, and I want to give you a token of, Weinberg said no. And he said, but I must, because you did do it, was a service, and said no. In that case, let me give you money to contribute to charity. And Weinberg said, if you insist, you give the money to charity in my name, if you want to honor me that way. And that's what happened. When the interview was over, a student was with Weinberg and he said, why did you refuse to take money for charity? And Weinberg said, look, this may be a pillar of German Orthodoxy, maybe completely committed to Orthodoxy. I suspect that in his mind, I'm an Ostjude. I'm an immigrant. And you know how East European Jews are. You give them money for charity, and the charity ends up being number one on the charity list. So I did not want him to have any question at all about that exchange.
Aside from the responsa, and you alluded to the two articles, Musser, what are the writings of the Lifrakim and the Mechkarim B'Talmud that Rabbi Weinberg wrote? And are those studied widely today?
Mechkarim B'Talmud is a volume within. Go through the four volumes, they're organized. Lifrakim was not a Talmudic work. It was published around 1936 in Germany. The truth is, the one piece of writing that I did in Weinberg was on Lifrakim. The practice in Hildesheim, or at least during Weinberg's time, was at the beginning of the term, he would give a general lecture, which would not be technically Talmudic, it'd be more general. One of those lectures was about how academic Talmud, or what you would call philology, would relate to Yeshiva Talmud, which he called Pilpul, and why both of them are necessary, and why a student in Hildesheim does not have to feel inferior, because in addition to doing pilpul, doing yeshiva learning at the highest level, we also are aware that the Talmud is an ancient book, and like other ancient books, it requires a certain kind of historical treatment. So I translated that into English, and published it in tradition. There is a German version which Mark Shapiro turned up in a newspaper. The newspaper outside of Germany, I believe, where they reported that Weinberg gave the inaugural lecture, and they presented a version. The Fakim also contained discussions about Gadita, you might consider more sermonic. The passage that I had forgotten about, but when I went through Mark Shapiro's book again, in honor of my being with you, Shapiro mentions a lecture in Lifrakim in which Weinberg excoriates in the strongest possible language the philosophical or scientific value of racial theory. And I remember the passage more or less. I didn't remember the context. And Shapiro says, you know, no matter how much Weinberg wanted to live in peace with the German government, and there were people in that world who hoped that Hitler would be, you know, be like the Tsar, they can, you know, garden variety anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. I recall when I was a child, I heard people telling me that some German Jews in the early 30s said, you know, when you cook soup, it's very hot. But when it reaches the table, you let it cool off a little bit. So there were attempts to communicate with it. Tell, you know, we have a lot in common. You're against communism. You're against Bolshevism. Don't you know that traditional religion is the greatest bulwark against communism? I don't think it cut very much mustard with Hitler, but assuming that he read it, got to him. So but still, when it came to discussing Jewish theology, discussing truth, apparently he was willing to say some very sharp things in a full awareness that it's conceivable that the government did have censorship, that they did have, and Lefrakim did have to go through somebody in the government who read Hebrew. And that is, I think, why he published those pieces there, and not maybe from an educational point of view, having books out there, having things that German Jews could read, that those who read Hebrew could read, was important. There was a lot of Jewish scholarship in Nazi Germany. And people who did their best to teach adult education, people like Martin Buber, who really waited until the last possible minute to leave, either because he felt responsibility for German Jewry, and or because his spoken Hebrew was not that good at that point, and he didn't know whether where he fitted Hebrew was not clear. It was a problem in moving him to Hebrew. People like Heschel may not have a choice. They were in several years where they were teaching adult education. Where they again, eventually Heschel was able to get out to England and from England to the United States. So there was a lot of activity at that point. Generally, Moti Rabbi or Wurzburger, who was a student at Alzheimer and walked the streets of Berlin the day after Kristallnacht, was afraid to go back to the dormitory. He didn't know what was going on there. He said to me, you know, if not for the destruction, German Orthodoxy was poised to take off and to do some very interesting things. If they had, if they had been active, a lot of the people who emigrated might have ended up making their careers there.
What was Rabbi Warenberg's approach to the state of Israel? And specifically, how did he respond to Ben-Gurion's question that was sent out to the wise people of Israel regarding who was a Jew?
Overall, he was pro-Zionist. In a way that anti-Zionists were not. And letters that he wrote more or less reflected that. When he was approached, I don't recall that his response was particularly exciting. I mean, the people who were Orthodox responded from an Orthodox point of view. And that was about it. And I imagine that's what Ben-Gurion expected. It may very well be that Ben-Gurion did not want to have to get into arguments about it. So when the question of Jewish identity came up, he punted. He said, I'll appoint the most respected people in the world, and they'll write. And they wrote back to him. A book was published, and that was the end of it. Agnon wrote very briefly. Agnon, if I remember correctly, was two lines. Nimnanu chiel shlomei emunei Yisrael. I am a devout Jew. And whatever devout Judaism says in the subject is good enough for me. just didn't get involved at all. I don't remember that Weinberg said something particularly sharp.
Why should young people today, aside from the scholarship and the Torah value of the response, why should young people study the writings and life of Rabbi Weinberg? Why is that important, if you think it is important?
We take some of the more homiletic works. Some are just good. They don't age. I'll mention one comment that lodged in me. Gemara says that if the law is that a slave whose master knocks out a tooth or an eye, that slave goes free. Kal vachomer, even how much more so that suffering is a good thing, that suffering elevates you. So Rav Weinberg asked, why does the Gemara say this? After all, in the Gemara and Gittin, we are told that not every slave wants to be free. Now, at a pshat level, I can argue with Weinberg. I can say that the view that he's quoting is one channel in among a variety of opinions. But he asked the question, after all, there are slaves who don't want to be free. And the psychology of it is understandable. Not every slave wants to be free. And his answer was, it's true, not every slave wants to be free. But if a man is a slave and his master knocks out a tooth, if he suffers physically from slavery, even the most abject slave at that point wants freedom. It's an interesting comment, and it's just as true today as it might have been in 1930. What he wrote about the history of Mussar, I think, is important if you want to know different views about Mussar, at least about Slobodka Mussar, which is what he was primarily concerned about. It does matter to us today. If Mussar is a live option, then we want to know what people think about it at that time. People were educated and people were capable of distancing themselves a little bit, writing a slightly more objective term. In terms of Psak, if you're interested in halachic rulings, this is somebody who was part of that world. If you're a student of halacha, and I wrote an abortion way, way back. I remember finishing a rough draft of the article during the time that Jimmy Carter was giving his acceptance speech for the first nomination. I remember writing that long piece, and Michael Weinberg was one of the major people in that discussion. You tell me you want what Poskim said yesterday. He's not there anymore, but in the halachic world, we do want to study important figures who passed. In Talmud, I'll tell you, when I look at Baba Kama, it comes up in the Yeshiva curriculum. I do take Zvi'esh off the shelf and I look at it and I reread that passage. Whether or not, I don't know how many Shibishik people are run to it right away, even know about it right now. And even in terms of strictly halachic writings, there are things that he says that are as inspiring today as they were then. I mean, one example in passing. his view of Rashba, that we don't make a bracha on mitzvot between man and man. Because, as Rashba, to say, Asher Kitshan Mitzvotav, God commanded us, and that's why we're doing it, but regarding other human beings, there's another reason we're doing it. Michiel Weinberg asked the question about Shalach Manas. Why don't we make a bracha on Shalach Manas? And various answers have been given to that question, but he says we don't do that because Shalach Manas is an act of friendship. And if you're saying, well, I'm doing this because God commanded me to do it, then you're diminishing that element of friendship. Again, it's a two-page discussion, but it's something that's worth reading. But those are justifications for Talmud Torah in general. Clearly, within Talmud Torah, in the real world, there are people who are in and people who are not so in, and people who remain relevant and people who are less relevant. And that leads to the last point, that in part, the combination that he made of academic scholarship and lamedus isn't still is not that common today. Many people try to do it with various degrees of success. And regarding matters of that sort, it's not the information that you want. It's really the how, and not just the what. Let me quote somebody who studied in Slobodka, went in a somewhat different direction, Rav Hortner. There's a line in Rav Hortner. Rav Hortner asked, why is it that the Gemara says that the Baal Halacha is called the Mash'ein Lechem, the staff of bread, and the Baal Agada, the theologian, is the Mash'ein Mayim, the source of water. Playing around with the pasuk, and you're taking word here, word there, and you're trying to make a sermon out of it. What does it really mean? And Putner's answer was that halacha and agada are very different in the way we study them. In halacha, you're talking about truth. Either this is true or it's not true. And once you know what's right or what's wrong, is this permissible, is it not permissible, you have your information. So there, it's like bread. When it comes to eating, the halachic measurement of eating is objective. You eat a kazayit, the size of an olive. If you want to be out, say, you want to perform a certain mitzvah. On Yom Kippur, it's a slightly larger measure. But everybody has the same measurement. It doesn't matter whether you are a one-year-old baby or Og Malach HaBashan, giant. When it comes to water, the measurements are different. And you kept talking about Lugma, you fill your cheek, and there we know that the cheek of a one-day-old baby is generally a lot smaller than that of Og Malach HaBashan. What the Putin derives from that is that in the study of halacha, one size fits all. In thought, in what you might call personal style or who you are, everybody has a different measure. And that's why it's important to learn from many people. Now, you could say that the same thing is true in halacha. that a lot of what we do in halacha is not simply reading Shulchan Aruch and finding out what's permissible, what's not permissible. It also builds a personality. And there's a difference. You learn from different teachers. You end up being a different person because you have that mixture of influences. But people may be attracted to Michiel Weinberg because he was an unusual personality. You want to make a short list of people. I mean, I wrote about him because I thought that his combination of hala, of lumdus and philology was important. I mean, I knew other people who do it, but not anybody else with the same degree of piety, not anybody else with the same degree of mixture with the same kind of dialectic going on. I wanted to be exposed to that. I wanted to live with that for the amount of time that it took me to do the translation and the amount of time that it takes me to do the reading. You want to live with that. And there, I think there are a lot of people who are who want to be attracted to that, who want to experience that.
Well, we could probably go on and on. This has been fascinating. I urge all our listeners and viewers to look up Professor Carmi, Rabbi Carmi's works on not just Michiel Yaakov Weinberg, but his many other works. And again, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
And, hope that the audience will too.